I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, I don't know about anybody else, but I started feeling guilty as we were talking before we started recording the show, because I just spent Friday cooking an entire Thanksgiving feast for my family.
I saw you posting quite a bit about that on Facebook.
Which I don't think is on your, I don't know how that works into your diet stuff. Is that a cheat day for you?
It is, mostly so my mother doesn't get mad at me. But yeah, that's...
Oh, well, you can't have your mother mad at you, John. That's just...
No. That's no, it's easier just to eat. And then I just embrace it and view it as a cheat day number, you know, an early cheat day for the week. But yeah, and it was good. My Thanksgiving was good. Today, we have RJ Theodore as our guest. RJ writes nonfiction, or I'm sorry, she writes her fiction books under RJ Theodore, and she writes some nonfiction under her name, Rekka J. She's got lots of books out there, and she does a podcast and all sorts of cool stuff that I think our listeners will be interested in. And thank you for joining us today, Rekka.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have a podcast called The Hybrid Author Podcast, which is not surprising because it looks like you are a hybrid author. And perhaps to our listeners, I think a lot of our listeners know what that means, but maybe you can give a little snapshot of what a hybrid author is and then why you would consider yourself a hybrid author.
A hybrid author would be someone who refuses to commit.
I think I had an ex-girlfriend.
She was a hybrid girlfriend.
Yeah.
She was a hybrid girlfriend.
A come and go author. The idea behind the Hybrid Author Podcast was that there are a lot of podcasts out there on the writing craft, which might be geared more toward an author who is focused on a traditional publishing path. And then there are a lot of podcasts out there about marketing and production for people who are 100% convinced that traditional publishing is the devil and that the only way to go is to self-publish. So
Chris Rush.
Okay. Hey, I'm not naming names. So the Hybrid Author Podcast came about when a friend of mine asked me, so when are you going to start a podcast? And I said, well, I don't know. You have the equipment. When do you want to start it? And this is Brian Williamson, my co-host, and he and I decided that in order to have a podcast that was worth adding our voice to the internet din, we wanted to sort of refuse to draw the line in the sand of whether we were for TradPub or whether we were for the do it completely yourself and be as savvy as you can be path of self-publishing. And so we want the craft tips of the world that's focused on the writing and writing the best book you can, plus the marketing tips of the make as much money as you can kind of aspects of self-publishing. And in there, we are also talking to people who have both self-published and traditionally published, or folks who are self-publishing but selling the rights overseas. Hybrid publishing can take a lot of forms, so it is a very wishy-washy definition, which is why it just took me 6 minutes to describe.
Well, I have a couple questions from that. First of all, on your website, you have a couple of series listed in your fiction writing, and mm-hmm. one of them is through Parvis Press. Is it Peridot Shift series? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, so there are three acceptable pronunciations of the word, and I use Peridot.
Peridot. Okay, mm-hmm. So you have the Peridot Shift series, and then you have the Phantom Traveler series, mm-hmm. which you self-publish.
Yes.
And
I believe that's pronounced Phantom.
Phantom, sorry. Yeah, thanks. Was there specific reasoning why one series went to a traditional publisher and one you decided to self-publish?
Well, the Peridot Shift series, which includes Flotsam, which is my novel, first full-length novel, which came out this March of 2018, and that was also going to be self-published. That was my intention. And the December before I was planning to publish it, I heard something, and I think it was David Galgren talking about how Amazon had, you know, boned its self-published writers again by deleting people's accounts when they got BookBubs because suddenly there was a spike in traffic and they saw it as suspicious. And it just sounded like a whole lot of like, wow, I really don't want to go this alone, maybe. And I was working with a developmental editor, John Adamus, at the time, who was also at the time working with Parvus. And so I said something to him about, oh, I should just submit this. And he's like, do it. Because that was always his advice whenever I said I was going to do something. He would say, do it. And so I did. And that afternoon, I submitted it to his publisher because he'd helped me so much on my book. I figured, hey, I'll throw this at his publisher first because, you know, that way he gets like double credit for the book. And then I moved on with my life because I honestly thought that the life experience of getting a rejection from a publisher would be interesting. And then I could go back to the plan of self-publishing. So I kept working on it. And then I got a call from Colin at Parvus Press, maybe a month later. And he said, would you please stop spending your money on this? We want to talk to you about this. We just need, you know, to clear the board with everyone here at Parvus first before we can approach you about it. So I stopped spending money on it for a little while. And I was still thinking like, oh, well, this is going to be awkward. I'm going to have to reject them.
Sorry, that's like, I want to say that's like every author's dream.
Right,
to actually send a rejection letter. Oh my God.
Yeah, so instead of receiving one, because I figured either I will receive one or I will say, oh, no, thank you, and continue on my merry way with the plan that I'd had, which is why I, you know, 100% kept going on. I bought the cover for the book at the time. I was hiring someone to do the sales copy. And so so I was like, all right, I'll put the brakes on this for a few minutes. And then they called me and I was actually, by the end of the conversation, I was feeling really good about their enthusiasm for the project and what they had in mind and what they would be able to help me do with it. So, and now this book was not like, I want to self-publish it because I want all the money. It was, I want to self-publish this because I don't want to go through the process of having someone else dilute the story so that it's more marketable, because this book is frankly, a genre hopper. You know, we've jokingly called it a, space punk steam opera because it combines some space opera elements. It has some steampunk elements. It has some not quite high fantasy, but it's definitely got that sort of like, you know, take the ring to the volcano sort of aspect to it. And so I thought that if I ever got through the door at a publisher with this book, that they would want to dramatically change it and rein me in. And I didn't want to be reined in, and Parvus didn't want to rein me in. So that like broke down a lot of my resistance right out the gate. The reason that Phantom Traveler was self-published was because I wanted to play around with the Patreon, you know, formula. And so I wanted to create content for patrons and have it specifically tailored to Patreon and also have it not be so marketable. I guess I might be ill-advised in my story types, but I don't write to market because I write books that like I want to read. And if there's a book that I want to read and it's marketable, it probably already exists. And then I could just go read it instead of putting all the work into writing it. So when a zany out there idea occurs to me, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to write that one. So Phantom Traveler doesn't have any human characters. It's from the point of view of an alien who partially communicates through chromatophores and iridophores under her skin. And so I play around with identity and language and the use of fine arts and just for the sake of fine arts, she's also a painter. But the Phantom Traveler stuff came out of this idea that I needed to build a wiki, and wouldn't it be fun if my wiki for the Peridot Shift was through the perspective of an alien who visited this planet, so that you could have the outsider's description of the planet, because of course to the people on the planet everything is normal. So I was playing around with that, and then of course the character took on its own thing and has never been to Peridot at this point.
Nice. Well, that's a lot. That's you
yes,
got a lot
I'm
going on. No, I'm happy.
Well,
yeah.
And that's really clever. Yeah, and that's really clever to do it from the Patreon model.
Yeah.
People were playing around with it, and it was still pretty young when I started. And then again, something about December, the December before I launched my Patreon, Patreon put out that announcement that they were going to change their fee structure and all that kind of stuff. And I said, oh dear, that's not what I want either. And I decided to launch Phantom Traveler through my website as a website-based subscription using the S2 member plugin for WordPress. And that got really complicated as well. And did not have, like, I didn't promote it very strongly. If you look back through my blog post, or actually I don't even think it's gone live yet, but it will have by the time this goes live. I just updated the artwork for The Bantam, which is the first novella in the series, which is available in bookstores and will lead people to Patreon by the end of it for the serialized format that it's taking. But yeah, I sort of soft launched it and I got a few subscribers through my website. But then when I relaunched it to Patreon later, when it became clear that Patreon was not going to, in fact, pursue those fee structure changes, then it started to get more popular and got more people.
Awesome. Well, I feel like that is a great segue here to talk about our Patreon for a second. So everybody, thank you who already support us on Patreon. It's over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We really appreciate all the support that you give us. We wouldn't be able to do the show without you. I mean, I guess we would, but it would. Patrick and I would have that monthly conversation about, like, well, this kind of costs us a lot of money to do this. Do we want to keep doing this? But we don't have that conversation anymore because of Patreon. So for those of you who back us, thank you so much. And for those of you who aren't, we ask you to consider becoming one of our backers. You could do $1 a month. You could do a couple dollars a month. You could do $5 a month. You could do $1 million a month. There's no limit. You could do whatever you want. So just go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and consider backing us. Now, let's move on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Rekha, do you have a pick ready?
Well, you might have figured out that I'm a little overzealous when it comes to answering questions, so I have three.
That's fine. You'd be surprised how many people actually do that.
It's pretty much everybody.
So when I hear an episode that only has one, it means you edited it out, right?
No, not some. Sometimes people only have one, but generally speaking, I don't think Patrick would edit something like that out.
No,
he just edits out my ums and uhs and you knows and all of my verbal tics, but he doesn't usually edit out stuff like that.
Well, my first one, I decided to bring some for the writers and some for everybody else. So the first pick would be writingtheother.com, which is a fantastic site that provides masterclasses on writing inclusively, so that you do justice to people you are writing about or using as POV characters, that does them justice without being stereotypical or without being, you know, even worse, racist or otherwise, or abled or everything. So that was my pick for writers. And they have several options and I have used them all. So I would definitely recommend that, because we want to increase inclusivity in our writing and in the stories we tell. So if it's important to do fair justice to those people we are representing that we are not ourselves. And then my pick for everyone else is, two picks for everyone else. One is the new She-Ra series on Netflix. I think you guys have mentioned that recently, but I finally got to sit down and start it after I finished a revision last weekend. So now I am like halfway through the season and I'm really loving it. Reminds me a lot of like Last Airbender in the stories of friendship and all these sort of like non-romantic centric storytelling about people coming together and deciding their own fate. And then my pick for everyone, absolutely everyone, writers included, is electrolyte supplements. Just because our soil is stripped of most of its nutrition, so you're probably deficient in magnesium. And I have a feeling if you took magnesium, and take good quality magnesium, don't take like the stuff that's basically the pre-surgical procedural juice that they give you. I take chelated magnesium glycinate, and I take 400 milligrams a day, and it helps with your nervous system and your muscles and your joints and your digestion and your brain and all that kind of stuff. So that's good for everybody. And if you watch your carbs, you can also add sodium to your diet. But if you don't watch your carbs, you probably don't want to add sodium. But sodium is important too. And we tend to villainize it, but it's so important. It makes your organs work. And that's kind of cool.
I take a magnesium supplement because a few years back, I started getting leg cramps again,
mm-hmm.
which I had, you know, growing pains, obviously, in high school. But a couple of years ago, I started getting really bad leg cramps again. And my girlfriend at the time suggested magnesium. And then my doctor also said, you need to take magnesium. So, and I'm terrible at remembering these things. I know it's not like what you buy at the grocery store.
Right.
It's something different. And it's, and it's supposedly better.
Yes. So, I recommend the brand Doctor's Best, and that's where you can get that. The reason I take the form that I do is because it's more bioavailable, and that way you are actually absorbing it into your body and it's not ending up inside your intestines,
right.
Pulling out the water, which is what like vitamin C will also do. And that's why there are drastic effects to taking too much of either of those things,
mm-hmm.
Which I won't describe because everyone knows what I'm talking about. But yeah, the interesting thing about electrolytes is there's a hierarchy in your body. So your body goes through your sodium first. And then if it runs out of sodium, it goes for your magnesium. And then if it runs out of magnesium, it goes for your potassium. And each of those things are important for your body's functions, like organs and neurons and heartbeat and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So if you get to the point where your body is draining your potassium, you're in big trouble. But potassium is not one you want to supplement without your doctor, because that can also cause problems. So just get your potassium from your food, and get your magnesium from, you know, a high quality supplement, because you're not going to find it in much food. Dark chocolate and avocados and that kind of stuff will have some magnesium. But again, if our soil is stripped, which it is, then it's better to get a high quality supplement that you can trust.
And since we're recording this after Thanksgiving, obviously you get your potassium from your banana pudding.
Well, actually, the best source of potassium that I've been told by a doctor is to take like your meat drippings and saute up some vegetables in that. And that is like a fantastic source of potassium.
Ooh.
And I don't mean the turkey meat. I mean like the beef roast you have after you're sick of eating poultry for a week.
Sure.
Nice. Wow. A lot of stuff there. And yeah, a lot of stuff we want to get into from that. Thank you for recommending the She-Ra's. If I wasn't watching enough cartoons on Netflix already, but I'll throw that.
Oh, every time I log into Netflix, it does that autoplay on the She-Ra trailer.
Yeah.
Every single time. So yeah. I've already added it to my list. I just haven't started it yet.
It's really great.
You made the Avatar comparison, which I just said like in our last episode, like I'll watch anything that's from one of the, I know this is not the same makers, but mm-hmm, if it's a similar aesthetic, I'm sure I would like it then. Cause I love it.
Well, visually it's not quite the same. It's more about the way that they put together, the friends, and they throw people together, and how their confidences and their idiosyncrasies play off each other.
Yeah, well, that's the story's more important. I mean, I like the look of all the Avatar brands of stuff, but it's mm-hmm. yeah, it's oh, more definitely. About the storytelling than anything else. Cool. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
Well, since we're talking about Netflix, a little while ago they dropped every conceivable version of Monty Python that you could ever want to watch.
Nice.
Including documentaries about the Pythons. And so you can watch the regular show. They've got little collections like The Best Bits. They've got one that is a Steve Martin special where he picks out his favorites. You name it, they've got it. They've got the movies now. All on Netflix in America. And because I know that it was on Netflix outside of America for a while, but I want to say a month or two ago, they finally dropped all of them on our version of Netflix. And so I've been kind of piecemealing a few little things here and there of Monty Python, including there was a great documentary Before Python, where it talked about how the six members met and came together. And that was a really good one. There was also another one that I believe was an anniversary for The Meaning of Life, where it was the five remaining cast members. And you had Cleese, Gilliam, Jones, and Palin all in London. And you had Idle on video from LA, and they were just talking about a bunch of different topics. And what struck me is, you know, these are all very older gentlemen now, ridiculously intelligent.
Yes.
You don't really get how intelligent they are until you get them talking about other things. And that particular documentary or whatever the hell it was, really illustrated that. You know, these are guys who were educated at Cambridge and Oxford. And like I said, just really, really smart guys.
Cool. Cool. Awesome. All right. I can't decide what I'm going to pick, so I'm going to throw it to you guys. I can either, the two books I just finished, one is another Stoicism book, because I read a lot about Stoicism, and one is a nutrition diet kind of science book. So, Rekha,
what would you do? The nutrition diet.
I think that seems to be in our theme right now. So, yeah, I believe I picked. This is the author is Gary Taubes, and I think I picked his first book a couple, or the first book that I read of his, which is Why We Get Fat. I feel like I picked that a few weeks ago or a month ago. But I'm going to pick his first book now, which is called Good Calories, Bad Calories, which, interestingly enough, Why We Get Fat was written as a follow, not even really a follow-up, almost more of a like a summary of good calories.
For the
yes, because good calories, bad calories, a lot of people who read it were like, this is really important and you need to get this out here and you need to make it more readable. So I listened to the audiobook of both of these, and Good Calories, Bad Calories is about like a 9-hour audiobook. I'm sorry, Why We Get Fat is a 9-hour audiobook. Good Calories, Bad Calories is like 24 hours. So it's like three times as long. I would recommend reading them in that order too. Read Why We Get Fat first. It is a much better book in terms of clearly presenting its message and the science about it. And then if you want to go deeper into the research, then read Good Calories, Bad Calories, because it's a lot of research and from the past like 100 years. And as I think I mentioned when I picked the former book, it's as people listen to the podcast, I've done this thing called the slow carb diet for about 5 years. I lost 30 pounds on it, and I've kept it off the whole time, and I'm much healthier and in better shape and all that good stuff that I always talk about. But I really have enjoyed reading both of these books because I understand the science a lot more now, and I understand the benefit. Because if you do these kinds of diet, and we'll throw this kind of to Rekha in a minute, because she actually has written many keto diet books, which there are similarities. And if you read, I'm sure you may have read these books. Rekha, did you read either of these books, Good Calories?
I actually have not. I have listened to Gary Taubes on several podcast interviews, and shame on me for not reading these, because they are pretty fundamental to the keto diet, which I am involved in heavily, including in my day job. So, it's really a black mark on my reputation that I haven't read them yet, but I do, to the degree that I've learned from other resources, understand the science that he's talking about. I know he's a super smart guy, and I am 100% behind you, and I will take that recommendation, because I really should have I really should have read both of them by now.
Like I said, read Why We Get Fat first. It's a much more accessible book. And then the other book I think is great, because it just fills in a lot of, you know, further science about it. But it makes me feel really good about what I've been doing. And if anything, it's sort of because on my diet there's like a cheat day, and I scale back that cheat day more and more and more these days, because I feel like my body is totally becoming intolerant to that stuff, and I really don't feel good after I eat that.
I myself do not opt in for cheat days. I used to opt in for cheat days, and then they became cheat weekends, and then cheat weeks, and then cheat months, and then eventually I would just start over on January. So the cheat concept never worked for me. I've started referring to them as retox days, because that's sort of what you're doing is you're reintroducing the toxins that you've managed to eliminate when you follow low carb or keto diet. And so I think you're right. And what people tend to do is go ham on those cheat days and eat everything that they've thought about in the last, if it's one a week, then everything they've thought about in that last week. And so then they're just, physiologically now redependent on those old flavors again. And so I'm behind your decision to keep those like low key cheat days if you've got to have them at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Not to.
Aren't your cheat days more around, you know, drinking a good beer?
Yeah, you know what's funny is I've even really scaled back on. I haven't really even had beer the last three or four cheat days. Yeah, no, mine are very. I'm not as crazy because I used to be. Yeah, I used to go crazy, mm-hmm. and it's been the past year or two I've scaled them back, and now it's really quite scaled. But I still I'll have pancakes. you know, but I don't go crazy all day. I basically have like one kind of bad one, and then, but anyway, yeah, not to go crazy about this. I'll say this, not to try to convince anybody to live a certain way or anything else. Here's what I say, why I think it's been important for me. My experience on this is that if you can feel better, both physically, and if you feel like if you have any sort of body image issues, which I think many of us do, and if it helps with that too, the less brain power you're spending on worrying about what your body looks like or dealing with pain and discomfort and being uncomfortable, or, you know, the more you can put towards more important things, and you can put that at anything, whether that's doing a you know, doing your job better or being a better spouse or parent or friend, or doing, as many of our listeners, like doing your creative things like writing or pod, it clears up a lot of things that you used to have to worry about. So for me, that is the reason why I stick with that. And so to have the science behind it is very helpful. So I would definitely check out Gary Taubes' books for that reason. So there you go. Now, Rekha, you know, we mentioned at the top of the show that you've written some keto books, and that's part of your day job. But do you find, since you've been on this, because let's, you know, we can talk about the actual theory behind it, and I'm interested in it. However, what I just said about it sort of helping with other aspects of your life, what is your feeling about that? Like, in terms of your creativity and your happiness as a person and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The, obviously, as so many people did, I came to keto for weight loss. I was sitting in an office chair all day, and it was not reflecting the me that I thought I was. And I kept, you know, denying that what was happening was happening, in terms of, you know, like I'd step on the scale and I'd go, yep, big boned. And then I was like, but I'm not really any different in size than I was, you know, a few years ago. And my bones keep getting more and more dense, according to the scale. So, you know, and this is not to say that one type of body is correct and another isn't. But for me, I was not seeing what I thought I saw in the mirror. And finally, I came to low carb, and that failed me on many, many occasions. I think there was just still too much of the junk in there, and I wasn't seeing a benefit to staying on it as much as I wanted to. When I accidentally stumbled into keto, which was by trying low carb one more time and doing a sort of 2-week kickstart thing that eliminated grains and all sweeteners, I found that I was suddenly feeling a lot more focus. I was less moody. I had back pain that was starting to fade as a result, and my skin cleared up, which for me had been a problem I'd been dealing with my entire life. And so I came for the weight loss, but I stayed for the mental clarity, and I stayed for the relief in back pain, which was, you know, if I was going to stay a writer and I was going to stay a graphic designer, it was something I was going to have to face getting worse otherwise. And so those are the benefits that kept me from ever going back. Also, when I reintroduced gluten accidentally, I was ill for 3 days, and I said, oh, wait, that's what I felt like every day.
Yeah.
and there, it was an option, apparently. It wasn't just required, you know, this is life. So when that feeling went away, I was done. And then since then, I've had a lot less. I used to have like heartburn a lot. And I would also get really bad cramping, you know, on my monthly term. That's pretty much faded as well. So, I mean, there's like so many good reasons. I didn't have a lot of pounds to shed in my, you know, in my goal. But everything else, you know, made it so much more dramatic a change in my life. And even, you know, people around me noticed that I wasn't moody or grumpy. And so to find out that people were noticing that I was grumpy and moody before and now could tell me that I wasn't, was like, oh, well, okay, I'm not definitely not going back.
Yeah.
But yeah, all those improvements were mostly mental. Mm-hmm. And also not to have that 2 p.m. slump. That really was, I was falling asleep at work. And the only thing that kept me up was chewing on my EL fudge cookies that I kept in my desk. And then, you know, I would say, okay, well, that was a lot of cookies. I should put these away. And then I'd fall asleep again. So I don't have that problem anymore. I usually don't even eat my first real meal until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon anymore. And I don't have those blood sugar drops and roller coaster rides. And so, yes, again, another 6-minute answer, but that's definitely like, that's the benefit for me is what it's done for me across the board with my health and my focus and my pain levels. Mm.
Yeah. And I will say, I don't want to be somebody that is pushing something on people. I get it, because no one likes to be told like what they do should do or don't do. And there's a feeling with this stuff, because I don't know, I certainly have felt this way about other things, is that like, oh, that's some weird cult. and I get it. I get why things like that seem that way, which is why I would say check out those books, or, you know, maybe even do what Rekha said, like, research Gary Taubes, because he wrote these books, and, you know, read some of his stuff, just because, as I think most people who listen to the show are pretty science minded, very proof driven, and you'll find out some stuff, and you can choose to then do whatever you want from that. But look, and I realize too with science, and that's what he talks about a lot in these books, is that science is kind of a weird thing, because you can kind of have science prove any point if you really, you know, yes, muck with the research.
Can be manipulated, absolutely.
Yes. So I realize I could probably read someone's, a different person's book that totally refutes everything in this book and will point out to all the relevance. I understand that. I get it. But all I could say is that I feel really good, and I've managed this weight now for a long time, and it's not hard. So, you know, if you're someone that, you know, is thinking about health or losing weight or something like that, I would check it out. So to kind of bring it to your writing, so obviously you've written some keto books. So how did that come about? Because now you were, I think before the show started, you had mentioned that that's kind of part of your job is writing some of these books.
Right. So I have written officially one keto book called Kick-Ass Keto, which I co-authored with two other people. When you look up Rekha J on Amazon, you're going to see my name on a few other cookbooks, which are covers that I designed. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, I officially have one keto title, and that's called Kick-Ass Keto. And that's a 28-day you know, kickstart guide for people who want to do it, but they literally want to be told what to do. You know, they want to be told what to eat, and they just want someone to hand them the knowledge, because all the science has them overwhelmed, et cetera. And there is some science discussion in it, which is really, really super layman, probably even more than Taubes's layman version. And it's just enough to get you in, getting you to sort of understand and let go of some of the preconceived or pre-indoctrinated kind of information that we have from our, you know, home ec days in school. And so how I got into that was that I was already doing work as a freelance graphic designer. As I mentioned, I did those covers. I was also doing a lot of branding graphics for Brian Williamson, who runs ketovangelist.com. And so when he and Carrie Brown, the other author of Kick-Ass Keto, wanted to put this book together, they approached me to do the layout. And then they had an aggressive schedule to get it out for January of this past year for the people who had, you know, New Year's resolutions. It's a hot time to sell a book. So it, you know, makes sense to release it for the new year. And they ran into scheduling problems, and I ended up contributing part of the writing just because I had more time than they did to finish the writing. And if they wanted it out for January, the writing had to get done. funny thing about books is people usually prefer that there be content in them. So, so yeah, I ended up working on that with them, and I had been, keto for, since like 2015, I think. Yeah. 2015. So I, you know, had most of this knowledge under my belt. This book was, I wasn't the target audience for this book. I was just, you know, was helping them out with it. And I had seen a lot of the same questions and seen a lot of the same experiences from people in the Facebook groups, that Keto Evangelist runs. And that's how I ended up, I joined those groups and then saw Brian call for a graphic designer, you know, early 2016. And I responded and I've been working with him since. And then in October, I just transitioned to working for him full time. So I do the branding, you know, graphic design and branding for Keto Evangelist now. And so obviously I'm kind of into this whole keto lifestyle. And so, yes, I've written some articles for ketoevangelist.com. For the website, for their blog. And I've also, you know, I'm co-author on that kick-ass keto book. And then most of what I'm doing right now is creating graphics and improving the websites and that kind of stuff now that I'm full-time.
So you're really quite a hybrid author because you have
hybrid everything.
You have nonfiction, you have fiction, you have self-published, you have going through a publisher. How do you as an author manage all that? Is there any particular strategies that you have between, like, do you, like, I'm going to write my fiction at this time of the day and I'm going to write my nonfiction here and I'm going to take on this project and I'm going to use this piece of software and I'm going to do a blog. Like, how does it all come together for you?
Yes. That is the universal question, right? So when I was, before I came full time on for Keto Evangelist, I was working a day job. So between 8 and 4:30, I, you know, could not work on any of these things except for maybe using my lunch hour to go work on something at a coffee shop. So I started in 2016, I believe, a daily practice which I published to YouTube called Asimov Hour. And so every morning I would get up early and before I had to get ready for work and leave, I would just write and I logged it. Sometimes I recorded my fingers on the keyboard and, you know, sped it up for brevity and would record a voiceover in the car to talk about, you know, what I was facing and all that kind of stuff. And so that helped me stay focused on my fiction writing. And I always try to do my fiction writing early in the morning because that's, you know, you're waking up from dream time, you're in this creative flow state, you haven't checked your email, hopefully, and you haven't seen anyone else in the house, because if you're getting up at 5 a.m., you're usually the only one. So it was quiet, there were no thoughts of what I had to do yet that day, and as long as I didn't look at my to-do list, I could write uninterrupted for as long as I could squeeze out. So if I got up earlier, I had more time for writing. So then I would go to work, do that stuff. At lunch, if I had something pressing for freelance graphic design, I would try to get that done. If I didn't, I would go to Starbucks, or if I had a deadline for, you know, a novel revision or something, I would go to Starbucks and work at Starbucks on my iPad, which has Scrivener for iOS on it. And then in the evening, I would usually, in front of the TV, I could do some of the graphic design stuff because it, you know, it wasn't like writing. You don't have to have your brain fully engaged in the words on the page. So that was how I balanced it before. And this past year, conveniently, we built a writing and art, because my husband's an illustrator, so it's a writing and art studio in our yard in a 12 by 16 shed. And so we have this dedicated space now for our creativity. And then suddenly I slipped into this full-time position. Now I'm working from home remotely. And so this creative studio, which was supposed to be like, when I'm here, I'm creative, is now like, when I'm here, I'm also maybe doing something for my day job, or I might be doing something for marketing, or I might, you know, might still be doing some of the freelance projects that I'm still wrapping up from my, you know, when I had freelance going outside of work. So it became very difficult to try and balance that. I would try to trick myself, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what works best. Like I have incense sticks and I have different scents for what I'm working on. So I have pine for my day job. I have frankincense for my writing. I have lavender and rosemary for my freelance design. So I'm trying to like give my physiological self these clues. I also have different logins on my computer for different job tasks. So I have a login for my writing, and I have a login for my day job, and I have a login for my freelance stuff. And so by changing which login I'm in, the background of my computer changes, the applications in my toolbar change, and in theory, this is all preventing me from, you know, losing my focus and just scattershot trying to run back and forth between different jobs, like, you know, just trying to get whatever I can done, procrastinating by saying, oh, well, if I go do that thing, that'll take me 5 minutes, and then I can get back to writing. So I'm still trying to write when I first get up in the morning. And then I'm trying to say, like, okay, here's the cutoff point where I switch to my day job. And again, it's remote, so it's flexible. So that could get me in trouble if I'm not careful. And a lot of it is just like, I have to hold myself accountable because no one else is going to. So it's kind of like graphic design, where I'm now head of a department. If I want this graphic design to be the best it can be, it's up to me. And I have to make sure that that's my priority.
Yeah, I really like the idea of having multiple logins depending on what you're working on. That's something that I'm curious about and that would maybe like to explore. I've had some issue lately because my main email address was specifically for kind of us doing this podcast, but also prior to that when I was pursuing doing the singer-songwriter thing. So it was sort of a split life from my real life. Mm-hmm. That became my main Gmail thing, that is like all my logins and everything. And I don't like to give that one out to people in real life, because it's weird, because it's like I have it like sort of a stage name versus my real name too. And similar.
Yeah.
So I always feel weird giving that one out to people. But so I give out my old email address but that forwards to my Gmail. And I've like missed some important emails lately because of that, because they're going to spam or whatever sometimes. So I need to get like a real life email address and maybe log into my computer as like my real life self and log. I don't know. It's always, I've been trying to merge this two parts of my life. And for the most part,
maybe you need to split them.
Yeah. Maybe I need to split them again. I don't know. It's something weird. I have to figure it out, but I do like that idea. That is, I'd be interested in exploring that for sure. Well,
so far it's working, but I'm only 2 months into it.
Yeah.
So it could all sink very quickly.
Yeah.
When things get busy, or, you know, I fall into the complacent zone.
Yeah. Well, if I've learned anything from this brief conversation that we've had so far, is that we should really have you back and really, because I think so many things that you're doing and that you're interested in are quite relevant to not only our listeners, but to Patrick and I as well. And I feel like we can do an episode on Scrivener, which we barely mentioned, an episode
yes.
on marketing, and an episode on the keto, although we did talk a lot about that, but we didn't even get that far into it. So we would certainly love to have you back on. As we wrap it up today, what would you like to point our listeners to that they can check you out online and maybe check out your books and perhaps your podcast and all that good stuff?
Okay. Well, one thing, if your listeners are interested in reading my fiction, I should mention that Flotsam is currently on a price promotion on all digital retailers for the ebook. So you might want to go check that out if you are curious at all. We barely got to touch on it, except that, you know, the story of where it's published. But Flotsam is the story of airship smugglers who have to choose between making a payday and saving the world from aliens, cultists, and angry gods. So if that sounds like it might be up your alley, then you can check that out wherever fine books are sold. And as I said, right now it's on ebook promotion, which I think is going to end by the end of the week. So that's something to hop on. The Bantam, if you're interested in my writing but don't want to commit to a full novel, is a novella. So that's only 18,000 words. And that is also available currently on Amazon, and I will be going wide with that pretty soon. So if you check out the books to read, that's the number two, bookstoread.com/thebantam, one word, then you can find that whenever that goes live. All the links will be there. And then, of course, Hybrid Author Podcast. If you are a writer and interested in both the craft and the marketing, then you can check that out at hybridauthorpodcast.com. And we have new episodes up every Thursday.
Nice. Awesome. Wow. I think that's a lot for our listeners to chew on. That's great. No, I know that they'll dig it.
If they've learned anything from me this episode, is that I am a lot.
Yeah. That's okay. That's great. For us, once again, thanks everyone for listening. If you dig what we do, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com /functionalnerds. Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
No, I just think this was great. It was a great episode. And you know, I do wish we had more time.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like this could have been a 4-hour episode. Well, we'll have to have you back sooner than later.
This could have been, I'd love that. This could have been an old school SF Signal, you know, 3.5-hour long episode. Yes.
Yes, yes. So thanks everybody. Rekha, thank you for coming on the show, and best of luck with all your stuff.
Thank you both for having me.
And everyone else, we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Mo. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
'You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.